From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, Atlas Obscura founder Dylan Thuris talks about spurring a spirit of adventure in all of us.
Later, gravity plays a vital role in holding planets together, but only to a point.
If I'm really close to the sun, for example, then it stands to reason that I'm going to be hot, and that molecule is going to be moving really fast. So gravity over a long period of time is not going to be able to hold on to me.
And choreographer Chelsea Hoy talks about making Irish dance interesting while keeping it authentic.
It's exciting to see where we can push the boundaries of Irish dance too, while still celebrating the integrity of this very ethnic art form that was born out of a struggle in Ireland.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Even on the coldest and gloomiest of days in a city like Milwaukee, we can open up a window on an exotic universe with a computer or smartphone. The internet has brought far-flung places and people closer to us. And one of the go-to resources to find places to go to is the website and social media feed Atlas Obscura.
The site connects travelers and would-be travelers with each other and with unique tourist attractions in all corners of the globe, 15,000 at last count. Atlas Obscura expanded to include a real atlas last year, and this month the Atlas Obscura Empire expanded again to include a book sharing unique places with a younger audience. And it all started here in the Midwest for co-founder Dylan Thuris. He was in Milwaukee recently and joined us on site at the Greenfield Public Library. Thanks for taking a few minutes to chat.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So how and when were the seeds of adventure planted in you?
Yeah, so I credit these Midwestern road trips that I went on with my parents. So I grew up in Minneapolis, and you know, I didn't travel anywhere exotic as a kid at all. I think I made it to Canada by the time I was 13, you know? But my parents did take me on these very quintessential Midwestern trips where we would, you know, it was like 6 hours between locations. And we went to South Dakota and saw Wall Drug and the Corn Palace, and we went to North Dakota and saw relatives. And we went to Wisconsin. And I went to a place when I was about 12 that is still one of my favorite places in the world. It is in Spring Green, Wisconsin, and it is the House on the Rock. Well known, I think, to Wisconsinites, but I still credit it as one of America's weirdest places. It is truly amazing. And it's funny because it's a place that either at some point you are screaming for an exit, you're like, get me out of here. I was just talking to someone today who had that exact reaction to it. Or you're like, this is a wonderland. I can't believe how incredible it is. For me, it was like, this is a wonderland. And for those who've never been there, it's got the world's largest carousel inside of it. It's got a giant hallway that looks like it goes on forever and is kind of cantilevered out over the forest. It's got a squid fighting a whale the size of the Statue of Liberty inside of this house. It takes 6 hours to walk through. Anyway, so that sort of got that going in my mind. And then there were sort of a few other things along the way. I mean, I liked books about this kind of stuff. I think most kids do enjoy books about, you know, ancient cults and hidden wonders. I would look at those Time Life books called Mysteries of the Unknown. Yeah. They had those ads that said, read the book, which those were, you know, they're full of sketchy stuff, but they were still fun. And then as I got older, as I was more of a teenager, 15, 16, Minneapolis, I was a straight edger as a teenager, so I didn't drink and do drugs, but I spent a lot of time exploring abandoned buildings, and that was another way in which I sort of got acquainted with the joy of place and places having their own stories and personalities. So those all kind of, and at that point, obviously, Atlas Obscura was nothing. It's only in retrospect that I look back and I see these kinds of things, but those all sort of started some of those interests forming.
Well, right. I was reading this latest book through the filter of, you know, what I have enjoyed it when I was a kid. And I got to thinking, you know, kids collect stuff. you know, at least my kids collect stuff. I guess your kids are probably, they maybe collect,
like,
you know,
acorn tops, right, and right, whatever they have in their pocket, the weird, like, Lint. Magical things in a 3.5-year-old's pockets are like, where did you get this? Anyway.
But the other thing they collect is cool experiences. Mm. You know, it's like, this book is really about collecting weird knowledge.
Yeah, and I think my hope is that for parents and kids together, it's a chance to just sort of go on this journey of imagination and curiosity and wonder in the world. And, you know, it's not a very practical trip planning book. You know, you're not going to go to Blood Falls in Antarctica. But each of these places, as you learn about them, hopefully it sort of expands your sense of what's possible in the world, how big our world is, how filled with sort of astonishing stuff and things still left to discover. I mean, the world's largest cave in Vietnam was discovered just a few years ago. And so this sense that there's still a lot out there and that we should approach the world with it, with that sense of kind of wonder is what I hope people come away with.
Yeah, do you think there's a certain inherent optimism in travel and writing about far-flung places?
I think there, for what we do at Atlas Obscura, there's an inherent optimism. I think that the inherent optimism is that the world is a beautiful, magical place. And sometimes the things are dark or sort of, you know, it's Skeleton Lake and they were all killed in a hailstorm and it's crazy. But it is sort of a reminder that our world is an amazing place. And I think sometimes our modern experience can feel very claustrophobic and sort of this, the world actually doesn't feel big. It feels like, oh, there's a typhoon in the Philippines and that's horrible and whatever. But it all kind of draws close, and I hope that sort of pointing out some of the stuff that people aren't familiar with pushes that out a little bit and makes you feel like, oh yeah, actually I know so little and there's so much for me to find in this world, and it's not even about going far away so much as approaching my own surroundings with that sense of questioning.
Right. I think when we're kids, we have this idea of just traveling the world and meeting people who are as nice as we are and having them expose us to the amazing things that they do when they come and visit. It's like, you know, pen pals in person.
Yeah. And I do think, I mean, there is something about travel. It's an excellent shortcut. Travel is just probably the most efficient shortcut to giving yourself new eyes, to seeing that world. So when you go somewhere new, you start to notice all these little things, like silly things, but you start to say, oh, the trash cans are different, and it's the streetlights work differently. And like that feeling when you kind of are, and it sort of brings you back into present attention, which you lose in your normal surroundings. And so it's just the fastest way to give yourself that sense of focused curiosity, I think. And that's just good for everyone. It expands people's perceptions, you know?
It was so cool, reading this, to see that you wrote about the fact that always used to blow my mind when I was young, and that was that South Africa has three capitals.
Yeah, so we filled the book with these, like, little obscure facts. Why was that the fact that blew your
mind? I don't
know.
You know, I do know. I know exactly why it was, because I was, as a kid, it was still in the days where you could get a shortwave radio, and, you know, it's so easy today. You turn on you go on your computer, and you can dial up a radio station from wherever you want. But, you know, I had a shortwave radio, and I found a radio station in South Africa, and they were giving the temperatures for different parts of the country. And they gave the temperature in Bloemfontein, which is, I think, how you say that. And so the next thing I did is I went to my world atlas and saw there it was, three cities in South Africa that each had the little capital symbol for them. And, you know, down the rabbit hole I went.
Why shouldn't more places have multiple capitals?
I don't know.
There's no good reason why you can only have one. We wanted the book to have a lot of these little kind of fun facts in them. We wanted to include some stuff that sort of was semi-practical. We talk about, a packing list and things like that. But a lot of it is imparting, like, the philosophy of Atlas Obscura, on how you look at the world. But
you're the gateway drug to the adult version.
Kind of, yeah. And we see them as sort of playing together nicely. Like, I think, you know, a savvy 11-year-old can take the sort of adult, you know, the book for adults and page through it and really enjoy it. And I think hopefully in the same way, an adult might be able to take this book and open it up to a page and get that same sense of wonder. But this, I do think this reaches an audience of 6, 7, 8 year olds who the big book is sort of too much. It's too wordy. It's too much book. And this, because it's illustrated, I think it sort of plays in that space between the real and the fantastical, and it kind of captures some of the magic and wonder of the world from a kid's perspective, you know?
Right, and as you say, there's a lot in this that no kid is realistically going to travel to. They might travel to in their mind, but I wonder if the inspiration that this book provides is to just be adventurous in your travel. You know, it's, you know, you go to New York, you don't just seek out the Statue of Liberty. You look for those weird, you know, whatever the New York equivalent of the Snake Rodeo or Wall Drug is.
Right, right. And I think, like, I don't need to go to Snake Island to love the fact that there's an island with one snake for every 3 feet, and they hang from the trees, and they eat migratory birds, and they eat each other, and it, you know, that just, unsurprisingly, I'm an enormous nerd. I also love reading, you know, personally, fantasy, science fiction novels, and I love that sense of magic. And I think for me, a lot of what Atlas Obscura is about is trying to imbue our own world with that sense of magic and to see things. You know, when you look at bioluminescence in the world, when you look at fireflies or the larval fungus gnats in Watomo Caves in New Zealand, where it looks like this sort of constellation on the ceiling, that is magic. I mean, that is genuinely like ripped from the pages of a fantasy novel, because it, you know, our world has that kind of magic, but it we have to engage with it. Like, if we sort of like, yeah, I know. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's sort of a way to just remind, in a way, it's like, for me, it's a way to remind myself, like, stand still and see the wonder in front of your eyes, you know?
Well, and what better way to do that than to take your kids someplace and say, check this out.
Yeah. And it's funny because, like, my children are tiny, 3.5 and 16 months. But the one thing that has been fun, and when I say travel with them, sometimes that means, like, you know, to the park. The way they engage with their physical surroundings is hyper-present and hyper-tactile and hyper-focused. And God, what I would give to capture, to be able to really get. And so it's, you can get a little bit of it, and you can try and put yourself in that place. But I've been trying, you know, to really, that a child's sense of wonder and amazement in the world is like actually everything that this is for me, and to sort of try and capture, to hold on to that as much as you can as you grow up and become an adult and like have a job and car insurance and whatever.
Well, and I was thinking I was going to ask this question, you know, with a sense of irony, but, you know, often when we engage with the stuff that Atlas Obscura is doing, we're engaging at our desk in a cubicle someplace or on the couch or wherever else it is that we are on our screens. But at the same time, as you're saying this, it's a rare opportunity to be in our cubicle or on our couch or wherever and be amazed by something.
Yeah, and hopefully it like nudges you out the door a little bit. But I'll say this too, you know, sometimes the attention that you pay in your desk to something online. I'm thinking of particularly the story of a place called the Chicken Church in Indonesia. A guy got a vision, you know, sort of one of these like dream visions to build a giant chicken. Well, it was supposed to be dove-shaped, non-denominational prayer house, but everyone calls it the Chicken Church because it looks like a chicken, and they all thought it was a Christian church because he's Christian. But anyway, he couldn't finish it. He ran out of money. It fell into disrepair. It was abandoned for years. In 2015, photos of this place start circulating online. Atlas Obscura, we didn't break the story, but we were sort of an early part of it. And so people start showing up. They go from being 10 people a week coming by and paying their dollar admission to being 100, 200, 1,000. Suddenly, there's money to support this thing. This guy, Daniel, who created it, is able to take that money, pour it back into the place, finish all these murals, set up the cafe and like the butt of the chicken where you can get some fried cassava. And he realized his dream because people were clicking around on their desks, you know, on interesting stuff on the internet. We live in such a weird interconnected world now. And so much of it is so gnarly. It's like you know, content farms in Macedonia pumping out, like, you know, right-wing memes. But there's another side to it. Sometimes, like, beautiful things happen. The chicken church, like, rises from the ashes, or the clown motel gets 100 bookings. You know, it's this place in Nevada. It's clown-themed. You get it. Anyway, sometimes there are wonderful unintended consequences of our attention. So anyway, side note.
Well, the wonderful thing is that with this book, one imagines that this isn't going to end anytime soon.
No, I mean, and the newest thing that as a company we're doing, so Atlas Obscura, we have this database of 15,000 places all over the world. That's kind of at our core. We do a lot of original editorial reporting, interviewing. We do events. We have 9 event chapters around the country, but we've recently, in the last 3 years, started taking people on trips. So we bring groups of 15 all over the world to Bhutan, New Mexico City, to Antarctica, we haven't gone to Antarctica, we're into the Arctic, sorry. And you know, it's nice to be able to sort of put our money where our mouth is and say, okay, the world is full of wonders, and now we can take you on a journey and contextualize the stuff you're seeing and tell you the stories that make you understand why it's wondrous and why it matters. I've always felt like that's often the problem with travel media, is it tends to be sort of like the nicest new vacation, you know, it's everyone's going to this beach or Iceland, hot new thing. And
we should note this book starts in Iceland.
I know, it has Iceland in it. Iceland is like a truly magical place. But, you know, it gets very repetitive and kind of in these narrow lanes, and like, it's a big world. And often what makes a place wonderful is not that it's nice, like a lot of nice is good, but it's all of the stories and the context and the people and the culture and all of that. And so that's what I, you know, like to focus on.
Dylan Thuris, thank you so much.
Of course, thank you. It's great to talk to you.
Dylan Thuris is the co-founder of Atlas Obscura. We spoke with him at the Greenfield Public Library, where he recently talked about the book for younger readers he co-authored. The Atlas Obscura Explorer's Guide for the World's Most Adventurous Kid. There's a link to Atlas Obscura's list of 16 cool and unusual things to do in Milwaukee at wuwm.com. And speaking of cool and unusual
things. Or maybe
things,
cool and a little unusual.
A little unusual for sure. We are having our fall pledge drive right now. We're asking you to donate to our station so you can support our coverage of cool and unusual things. The phone number is 414-227-3210. That is 414-227-3210. Or you can always head to our website, wuwm.com/give.
You know, talking with Dylan Thuris of Atlas Obscura is a good reminder of all the places that public radio can take you to, whether it's during news shows like Morning Edition or the BBC World Service or The World in the Evening, or it's on programs like Lake Effect, which sometimes take you to cool and unusual places in your own community. We mentioned Atlas Obscura's list of 16 cool and unusual things to do right here. But just in recent days, we included a list of some of the cool and unusual things to do during the recent Doors Open Milwaukee, which is just another example of, you know, how we kind of open a window onto the community that you don't really get in every other public radio show.
Yeah, what's great about Lake Effect is it allows us to take you into places that you wouldn't normally go and that we wouldn't normally go. And the way that we're able to take you to these places, the way that we're able to bring our listeners along with us, is through your donations. So please call us. The number is 414-227-3210. That is 414-227-3210. And if you donate $120 or more, that's about $10 a month, today you will receive a unique code to download Wait Wait's 20th anniversary best of album to your computer or smartphone.
So you can be listening to that even as you peruse all the options on Atlas Obscura.
Indeed, indeed.
414-227-3210. We have a goal of 8 new members this hour, so that's a pretty eminently makeable goal. We can do it with your help. Again, 414-227-3210 or wuwm.com/give. A quick break now, and then our astronomy contributor takes us even further afield than Atlas Obscura. We'll talk with Gene Creighton when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Last month, astronomy contributor Gene Creighton explained how the sun stays together, even though it's made of gases and plasma.
This month, Lake Effect's Bonnie North wanted to take the conversation one step further and talk about the same issue only as it pertains to planets. Bonnie asked whether gravity plays the key role.
That's true, yeah.
Okay.
But you will see, though, that different planets have atmospheres and certain planets don't. And the same is true of moons. Some moons have an atmosphere and some moons don't. Again, one of the major criteria is the size, the mass that planet or moon has, and that's directly proportional to how strong gravity is. The more mass it has, the stronger the pull. But here's the clue. If you are, let's say, a molecule of oxygen and you're bouncing around a certain planet, you're not going to have the same speed because your speed depends on the temperature. So if I'm really close to the sun, for example, then it stands to reason that I'm going to be hot and that molecule is going to be moving really fast. So gravity over a long period of time is not going to be able to hold on to me. Eventually, I'm going to have what's called escape velocity. So eventually, I'm going to be able to say, sayonara, baby, I'm leaving, and not come back. So places like Mercury have a hard time holding on to their atmosphere. Now, say you go out to Saturn. Well, that planet is really big. That means that the very outer layers of the atmosphere are not so close to the center. So the farther you are from the center of the planet, the less you feel the pull of gravity. Mm-hmm. And those molecules are really, really cold.
I was going to say, you're very far away from the sun.
You are.
Yeah.
So those guys are pretty slow. And they're not going to leave. They don't have escape velocity because they're too cold. And a place like, say, Pluto even, again, slow moving particles, so Pluto gets to hold on to its atmosphere. Now, this is not always the case. Just because you're cold, you're going to keep an atmosphere. There are places, there are moons that are small enough that they just simply don't have enough gravity to hold on to it at all. They just don't. So those guys are going to fly away.
Is that true for our moon?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it totally, goodbye.
Just not big enough to hold.
No,
no.
Yeah. So it's interesting how there are all these little parameters that determine whether you're going to be able to keep an atmosphere over the long run. Again, even if, let's say, most of your molecules, the temperature that you have, most of your molecules are just around that escape velocity. If you're sitting around for a few million years, over time, the tail, if you will, of the distribution, there'll be enough particles leaving and not coming back.
Yeah.
So I mentioned, of course, the term escape velocity, and I don't know if people know what that means, so I guess I should explain it. The escape velocity is the speed you need to give a particle for it to leave and not come back. As you know from your own experience, if you toss something in the air, no matter how hard you try, it's going to come right back. But if you happen to have a rocket and you want to say goodbye to your keys forever, you can put your keys on the rocket. You can get it's 25,000 miles an hour. If you can achieve that speed, you will not see those pesky keys again. So the idea of escape velocity is connected to two things: how far the object you're trying to get rid of is from the center of the attractive, let's call it, planet, and it depends on how much mass there is. Which brings us to the idea of a black hole, which is not where I suspect we started our conversation, might as well go there.
Yeah, because I think that's where most of us have heard the term escape velocity, either space flight, you know, mm-hmm. being able to get off a planet and get into space, and also trying to escape a black hole.
Right. So the idea was, if I squeeze enough mass, a lot of mass, into a small enough volume, which means that the object at the surface of this, let's call it black hole for our purposes, would be really close to the very center. That means that the escape velocity could be equal to the speed of light. And then light can't escape, and of course nothing else can escape. And this idea was not a modern idea. It was in the 1500s by a monk named Mitchell. And how beautiful that in the early 1900s, Einstein's equations just popped up as one of the solutions, a black hole.
He just like had his hand in everything, didn't he?
Yeah, pretty much.
in all of modern physics.
Yep.
Yeah, it's amazing to me how those two formulae explain so much.
Mm-hmm. It's a lovely thought experiment. It's a lovely way to ponder that, you know, with some physics, some sort of brain experiments, you can kind of ponder so much about the universe. And I'm thrilled that our brains work that way.
I know, me too. So I want to go back to escape velocity for a second.
Sure.
So that is a problem, I'm assuming, that we have to overcome if we want to travel farther than the moon. I mean, we have to do it to even travel to the moon. We have to figure that out, right?
Yeah. So you hit again the nail on the head. We can't spend the energy to overcome the escape velocity from the surface of the Earth all the time, every time we want to go anywhere, because then it just becomes too expensive. But if we started from the moon, then the escape velocity of the moon is a whole lot less than it is for the Earth, or maybe somewhere in orbit, because you start farther ahead of the game, as it were. So for long-term space travel, especially if people are involved, we would need to be starting maybe either somewhere in orbit or somewhere of the Earth or orbit around the moon for it to be even remotely practical.
Because we can't carry enough fuel, right?
That's right. We just can't carry enough fuel. That's right.
Yeah, we've already talked about not being able to carry enough water.
Yes.
then there's the fuel issue as well. And so no matter what, we're constantly dealing with the physical reality of the fact that the gravity is happening and things, you know, and we have to be able to
overcome that. Yeah. I was actually talking today to a student and they thought, well, surely we've been to Mars. I mean, they've seen the pictures, and it's hard to really communicate how hard it is to go to Mars and overcoming Earth's gravity with enough fuel so that you can send a person to Mars and bring them back is just not a solved problem yet.
Getting them there is easy. But getting them back is at this point impossible, right?
Not, right.
So it's a one-way trip.
It's a one-way trip, which we would rather not it be.
No.
Not certainly by design. So these are going to be exciting times of figuring out how we can do this as efficiently as possible. I'm sure that in the process of solving this kind of problem, other problems will be solved as well, which is one of the marvelous things about the study of space. We get wiser about things on Earth.
I was going to say science in general.
Yes, I'm with you. Yes.
Well, Jean, here's to a good rest of September. We will talk next month. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Jean Creighton is director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee and our regular astronomy contributor. She talked with Bonnie North, and you can find more of her Lake Effect Conversations at WUWM.com. Jean was talking about what keeps planets together. Last month, she talked about what keeps the sun together. You know what keeps this public radio station together and this show together? It is contributors, not just contributors like Jean, but contributors like you, people who contribute their money to keep this public radio station on the air and healthy for years to come. They do it by calling 414-227-3210 or visiting wuwm.com/give and making their contribution today.
You know, 80% of our funding actually comes from our community. It comes from listeners like you who say to themselves, well, I love hearing Jean Creighton every month. I love hearing about the things that are happening in my backyard, in the country, in the world. And the way that they're able to hear that, the way that we're able to bring it to you is through your donations. So please call us, 414-227-3210. You can always head to our website. That's wuwm.com/give.
You know, Joy, I tend to be a lot math phobic. And so I wouldn't talk about equations if it weren't something I could wrap my head around. The equation is really pretty simple. When you make a contribution to Milwaukee's NPR, it actually makes a difference. And the more contributions that we get, the healthier the station is, and the more ambitious we can be in taking on projects like, say, Bubbler Talk or the Informed Voter or any of the things, the Lake Effect On-Sites. These are all made possible through the contributions of people just like you. And today only, you not only get the satisfaction of making a show like Lake Effect possible, but you get something else.
You also today, if you donate at least $120, that's about $10 a month, you will receive a unique code to download Wait Wait's 20th anniversary best of album to your computer or phone. That's Wait Wait, Don't Tell Me's 20th anniversary best of album. I can't believe they've been on the air for 20 years. You will get a unique code that's going to be mailed to you, just as a heads up.
Right. It's not going to pop up when you, right, you won't click on donate now, and then the code pops up. It will come to you in the good old-fashioned snail mail.
But yeah, 20th anniversary, I can't even imagine what the best of that show sounds like.
Well, and of course, having been in public radio as long as I have, I still think of it as one of the newer public radio shows. So it says something about just how long I have been around. Somebody dust me off at the end of the day today. 414-227-3210, the numbers to call, or go online to wuwm.com/give.
We have one more break now, and then we will talk about one group's attempt to walk the line between traditional and new in the art form of Irish dance. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Despite her young age, Chelsea Hoy has become an influential name in the field of Irish dance. Hoy is the Associate Artistic Director and Choreographer for the Chicago-based, nationally touring Trinity Irish Dance Company. The company was founded nearly 30 years ago and terms itself the birthplace of progressive Irish dance.
Trinity will make its first Milwaukee area appearance in more than 10 years this weekend with Friday and Saturday performances at the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center for the Arts in Brookfield. Ahead of the shows, Chelsea Hoy joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North and talked about following in the footsteps of a giant in the Irish dance world.
I was recently named the Associate Artistic Director. It's a huge honor to carry on the legacy of our founding Artistic Director, Mark Howard's work. And he actually coined and created his own genre of dance, which is known as progressive Irish dance. And the Trinity Irish Dance Company is the only place where that exists. So it's exciting because there's no rules for us, so we're continuously redefining what that means. And so I'm at the front lines right now of seeing where that can evolve to. So progressive Irish dance, in the simplest terms, is rooted in the traditions of Irish step dance, and then we blend other art forms, and we learn new vocabulary from the experts in all different sorts of dance forms, different genres, so contemporary dance and...
One of the things that is great about seeing a performance of yours is how those things get blended together, whether it's modern dance or ballet or even Latin. I mean, there's other things that get pulled in to it, which happens in music a lot, but I don't think happens in dance as much.
Right, right. Yeah, it's exciting to see where we can push the boundaries of Irish dance too, while still celebrating the integrity of this very ethnic art form that was born out of a struggle in Ireland.
How did you get involved in the first place? Were you one of those little girls that was dancing from a very young age?
I'm actually from Denver, Colorado. So I grew up dancing. Well, I started at the age of 4, but then my mom asked me what my favorite part of dance class was, and I said, the water break. So she decided to pull me from classes at that time. But I picked it back up at age 6, and I've loved it ever since. And I moved out to Chicago for college. So I went to Loyola University. But I had actually seen the Trinity Irish Dance Company perform when I was 8 years old. So my aunt took my sister and I up to Beaver Creek. We drove through a snowstorm to see the Trinity Irish Dance Company perform. I remember exactly where we were sitting. I remember watching the pieces, some of the pieces which we still perform today. And then one of my former teachers had been in the Trinity Irish Dance Company, so she took us backstage after the performance, and I just marveled at the big girls. Ashley Pearl was one of the featured dancers, and she's very tall, so I specifically remember meeting her, but the strength of that performance really stuck with me. And then life brought me to Chicago, and in 2014, I went on my first Japan tour with TIDC.
Okay. And you're still based in Chicago now or Milwaukee?
I'm in Chicago, but the company's based in both Milwaukee and Chicago. So we rehearse right here in the Third Ward as well as in Chicago.
One of the things about this traditional step dancing, at least as we see it here in the United States, is that it is a very female-dominated form. We see more women doing the dancing. There are men. It's not that there aren't. But I tend to think of it as a very female-powerful kind of dance. Is that fair?
Yes. The Trinity Irish Dance Company is actually, that's a critical part of our mission, is to empower females on and off the dance floor. So as you said, this art form itself is naturally a very powerful art form. When you put hard shoes on, you not only get to make noise, you're expected to make noise. So that's always been my favorite part of dancing, is to be loud. But
something women aren't encouraged to do very often.
Exactly, yeah. But in the Irish dance world, Irish dance has kind of gone in many different directions. There's the competitive nature of Irish dance, and there's tons of local Irish dance schools here in Milwaukee that send their kids to feshes, which are traditional Irish dance competitions, and they learn resilience, and they practice their steps, and they win medals, and that's wonderful. But it can also, at the highest level, kind of tend towards a circusy, becoming more about the spectacle and the pageant and the dresses and the wigs. And so that's something that the Trinity Irish Dance Company is trying to pull back on. And we're really trying to refocus the conversation within Irish dancing on the integrity of the art form. And there's a lot of commercial Irish dance shows, which got their start actually with Mark's work in 1990. He reshaped what Irish dance could be when he brought it to the performing arts stage. And these commercial shows have made Irish dancing a global phenomenon, but some of them, such as Lord of the Dancer, there's a lot of offshoot. The role of women has become more of a background where the males are in the hard shoes making the noise, and the women are not making noise, and they're not wearing very many clothes, and they all fit a certain model. So the Trinity Irish Dance Company, while you said is celebrating what Irish dance is at its heart, we're actually going against the grain of where Irish dance is going right now.
And again, I celebrate that. One of the things about dance that always bothered me growing up is that it seemed like the boys got to do all the big athletic stuff and the girls didn't. They just got to be floaty and pretty. There's nothing wrong with being floaty and pretty, but I also wanted to be able to do the big athletic stuff as well. And so when a company makes it its mission to allow the full expression of movement for men or women, to me, that is just something to be celebrated.
Yeah, we are primarily a female company, so we have 18 female company members and 2 male company members. But in everything we do, we present males and females on equal footing. And so we have a piece called Push, which really is a virtuosic percussive piece. But anywhere else in Irish dancing, you wouldn't really see the girls jumping on stage to match what the guys are doing. And Mark always likes to say that sometimes we blow the boys out of the water.
Not that there's any competition.
No.
No, none at all. And so are you working on choreography as well yourself?
Yes, I actually just recently co-choreographed my first piece alongside Mark. For the past 4 or 5 years, I've been involved in the creative process of 6 different TIDC works. We have a lot of new rep, but the piece that we just choreographed will be previewed at our upcoming performance at the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center. It's called On Sorcus, which is Gaelic for the circus. So we wanted to create a big showstopper, colorful piece for the end of our show that involves our full ensemble, but we wanted to do it in a smart and twisted way. So it's a comment on the battle between substance and spectacle, which is a battle that we fight within our art form, but artists fight all over the world. And so I think, as a lot of people would agree, the priorities that people have today, or the focus that they put on material things, can be a little backwards. So the beginning of this whole piece is actually backwards. So the dancers start by bowing. And then the piece progresses to move into the Trinity Irish Dance Company. So there's a lot of layers within the lyrics, within the choreography, within the imagery, and the costumes. At the beginning of the piece, we wear jackets that represent the spectacle. And we actually made these jackets by deconstructing Irish dance solo dresses, which are the glittery, very expensive dresses that kids are wearing in competitions. And they're always vying for the next dress or what's the newest style. And we had a bunch of old costumes that we were able to tear apart and piece back together. So we wear those jackets, but then halfway through the piece, we take them off to reveal the rawness and the honesty of the Trinity Irish Dance Company.
So in this first experience of co-choreographing, what did you learn? I mean, you've been performing for quite a while. Now sort of the hat is on the other direction,
right?
You know?
Yeah. Well, Mark's in a mentoring phase right now. So he is teaching this very specific taste level that can't be learned in a book, and you can't go to school for it. It was just born out of Milwaukee and Chicago in the Trinity Irish Dance Company. So for the past couple years, I've been learning and watching that style and engaging with different choreographers from all different genres. But my first time choreographing was challenging, but it also was very natural. And Mark and I have found that we are very synced in the way we know when something's right, and we can't quite describe it, but we just know that it's there. So it was really thrilling to create that piece on all of the dancers, who I am one of them as well, and then get to see it previewed for the first time on a Japanese stage this past summer.
Very cool. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
And I imagine that in this, it's sort of like a mantle passing, you know, that Mark is eventually going to retire, you know. And
I hope not.
Yeah, well, exactly. But at some point, he probably will, and you're probably either being groomed or whatever to take over. I also think that your experience as a woman in this environment is going to inform how your choreography
Definitely.
Expresses itself as well.
Definitely. I'm in the very, very beginning stages of our next piece that Mark and I will be choreographing together, but hopefully mostly me. He wants to kind of be in the background for that one. But it has the working title of Heroines. And this is a piece that the whole thing will take place in a circle. So the Trinity Irish Dance Company taps into the power of a circle throughout our show, but we're looking to create a piece that is engaging the whole time, that brings in lots of layers, contemporary movement, percussive, maybe vocals, but it's all based around the concept and the idea of a circle. So the initial conversation was that this piece would go in three different stages. You would find a problem, seek a resolution, and then take a stand. But I personally will be choreographing this piece around the framework of the processing of sexual assault. But it will really be a piece about maybe times when you feel broken, or your power is a little on shaky ground, or it's been taken from you, and then regaining that power and using your support system and the people around you to put those pieces back together. So any audience member can relate to that very human emotion.
Well, and it's also something that you don't necessarily expect to see in an Irish dance company. And I love the idea that that's being pushed, those boundaries are being pushed.
Yeah. The Trinity Irish Dance Company is definitely a place that I feel safe. And it's a place where we learn to trust each other. And when we trust each other on stage, the audience can trust us right away. We like to break that fourth wall and reach out. So I'm really excited to see where that piece takes us. I'll be choreographing it from a very different place, where it's just a concept in my head and there's drawings on paper right now. But one of the things I'm most excited about is the inclusion of a swing. So I want to have a swing in this piece, upstage right. And this swing, the whole time throughout the whole piece, will be occupied by a little girl that is from the community wherever we're performing. So before the performance, we'll be reaching out to all the children's organizations to find the girl that wants to be on the swing and wants to be that representation of resilience and the innocence of a child throughout this whole piece. So no matter what's going on in this circle, that child will be there swinging.
I don't think you'll have any trouble finding little girls who want to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's just a really cool thing. Well, when that comes to fruition, you have to come back.
Yes,
and
definitely.
Talk about it. Or maybe I can actually go to you and talk to
great.
Folks in the rehearsal process, you know, and do all of that. But Chelsea Hoy, I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking with us today. Best of luck in your new role and continuing to dance as well. And we look forward to seeing you at the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center.
Thank you. We'll see you soon.
Chelsea Hoy is the Associate Artistic Director and Choreographer for the Trinity Irish Dance Company. The group will perform Friday and Saturday night at the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center for the Arts in Brookfield. She spoke with Bonnie North.
The last time Irish dance was in the bright spotlight in Milwaukee was likely during Irish Fest in August. That's also when traditional music was in the spotlight here. We have a few minutes to hear a recent Lake Effect studio session from around that time.
The group Shreem takes a similar approach to the one we just heard Chelsea Hoy describe, adding contemporary layers to a traditional art form. Here they are from a studio session in August with the song Hello World. Shreem playing Hello World in the Lake Effect Performance Studio in August. You can find the full interview with them at wuwm.com.
That's also where you can play a role in our fall membership drive, which is going on right now. We have a goal of 8 new members this hour. We are on our way there. In fact, we're within shouting distance, but we're not going to shout at you because we are public radio, and that's not what we do here. We are, though, going to tell you the phone numbers to call, and those are
414-227-3210. The number is 414-227-3210, or you can head to our website, wuwm.com/give. And while you're there, you can check out a lot of our coverage about Irish Fest. You can check out the whole studio session with Shreem and the studio sessions with a number of Irish performers who we had a chance to speak with while they were here back in August.
And if Irish music is not your thing, we have studio sessions with a wide variety from classical music to choral music to singer-songwriters.
Alt-country, folk, whatever you're into, we probably have it.
And the reason that we have it is we've got this great performance studio that is next door to the studio where you and I are sitting right now. And the reason we have that studio is because of the generosity of contributing members like you who have, over the years, stepped up to the plate and delivered when it counts. 414-227-3210, the numbers to call. Or you can visit us online at wuwm.com/give and make your contribution today. And when you make a contribution today at the $10 a month level or more, you receive a really special way of saying thanks.
You'll receive a unique code to download Wait Wait's 20th anniversary best of album to your computer or phone. That's Wait Wait Don't Tell Me's 20th anniversary best of album. They've had a million lovely musicians on their shows over the years.
Right, and interesting guests from Tom Brady to Tom Hanks.
<It's true>. Tom Hanks was a host, wasn't he?
I think that's right.
Yes, for a very short period,
and did a really terrific job. He was a nice fit, and of course, Wait Wait likes to call itself your least trusted news source. Which you know, when you think of all the stuff that NPR delivers, it's nice that we have a sense of humor about things as well.
It's true. The code, by the by, will be mailed to you. It will not come up immediately. So when you call 414-227-3210 or go to wuwm.com/give, you're not going to see the code immediately. It'll come to you in snail mail.
Don't get frustrated. So again, thank you for those of you who have called or gone online already and played a role in our fall membership drive. And if you have not yet, this is the time to do it. 414-227-3210 or wuwm.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It is 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.